two authors of a new book titled Pongamos a los Padres Nuevamente a Cargo. That is to say, let's put parents back in charge, a book that is published both in English and Spanish, in one single volume. Those are two old friends, Joseph Bast and Herbert Wahlberg. Joe Bast is the president and the CEO of the Heartland Institute, which is a very important independent nonprofit research center, which is headquartered here in Chicago. Herb Wahlberg, who's been on this program on and off over many, many years, is research professor of education and psychology at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and is these days also a distinguished visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. And the new book is of almost pamphlet variety. It's thicker than a pamphlet, but it's shorter than your last book, which you also authored together, titled Education and Capitalism, How Overcoming Our Fear of Markets and Economics Can Improve America's Schools. Let's go back to the basic thesis. Herb Wahlberg, to what degree do American schools need improvement, and why?
American schools desperately need improvement. The series of international surveys that have been done throughout the world, including Asia and Europe and other parts of the world, including Mexico and Canada, indicate that U.S. students do very poorly in general, and that the longer they're in U.S. schools, the further they fall behind students in other countries. And what is particularly appalling is that we have either the first or second highest expenditures in the world. This is even more important these days, Milt, because we are entering the so-called information society. We have lots of competition with cars and technology and other sorts of things. So if our students are not performing well, then it doesn't bode well for our country.
So we're spending a lot of money and we're not getting sufficient bang for the educational buck.
Exactly.
What would a good bang be? How would you know it if you found it?
Actually, Carolyn Hoxby has done research that's exactly on this point.
Mm-hmm. She's a professor at Harvard, is she?
Correct, right? Yes. And she looks at test score results and how they've changed over time, and spending per graduated high school student and how that's changed over time. And then you can come up with a measure of productivity. How much does it cost to get one graduated kid through the system? And she finds that, I think her research went from 1971 to 1999. She found a 42% decrease in the productivity of the public schools in the United States.
Productivity measured by what standard?
By the test scores and spending. So the amount that it cost to graduate a single kid in the United States went up 42% over that period of time.
In real terms.
In real terms. Inflation adjusted
test
dollars.
Scores on what kinds of tests?
National
Assessment of Educational Progress. It's the standard. It's the state-of-the-art tests that are given to random samples of students in the United States.
Do we find time trends indicating a decline in performance on those standardized tests?
Generally speaking, they're pretty flat. There's a blip from year to year, and there are some differences among minority groups and with respect to poverty, but a fair assessment is that they've been rather flat, despite the fact that we've had so many so-called reforms and the substantial increases in expenditures.
It's on a scale of 500?
Well, 500 is the average, and there's a standard deviation of about 100. And you can look at these scores across time over a 30-year period for students in various ages and various subject matters.
I've been looking at high school graduates over a long, long time, all the years that I've been a college and university teacher. And I've said this to you before, I think, Herb. I've certainly said it on this program before. If I look at my extended academic career, which has been at good schools, it has been at Yale, Dartmouth, Ohio State University for a strange year and a half, and then the University of Chicago for a long, long time. And if I look at that and examine my memories of what students have been like and what they are like now, there's no doubt that every half decade or so, you sense another step downward in terms of literacy, in terms of general knowledge of history, in terms of intelligent, sophisticated orientation to the world around you and to the skills that are required, writing skills, evidence that more than almost anything else. When I started teaching as an assistant professor a long, long time ago, kids could write decent essays. My students at the University of Chicago over the last 10 or 15 years, some can write, of course. Lots of them can't and don't even get sentence structure, not to mention spelling, not to mention punctuation. The bottom seems to have fallen out in the preparation of students who are college-bound, in their preparation before they get to college.
And yet they're full of self-esteem. You know, the Heartland Institute, we do a lot of writing and publishing and editing. Yeah. It's what we do. Mm-hmm. We have 7 monthly publications, a total circulation of 140,000 copies. And so we're constantly trying to find people who can do that writing. And you're absolutely right. The kids who coming out of colleges, even University of Chicago, they can't write. We've got to start all over again, teach them paragraphing, punctuation. They aren't learning it in high school. They're not even getting it in college.
And they do the major course in the English department at the University of Chicago for some time has been the remedial one. They call it something fancier than that, but it's the one to try to get kids up to a proper level because they didn't get to that proper level in high school. So the high schools aren't functioning well. The elementary schools before them aren't functioning well. But some schools must do better than others. How does one, what is common to the schools that do better than the ones that do worse?
Well, I think one of the pitches that we make in this book is that, generally speaking, private schools do better than public schools. And something like 88% of the students in the United States go to public schools. There is more hope for private schools, including both parochial and non-sectarian schools.
An immediate response, pardon my difficult throat, an immediate response from a critical listener, and perhaps from a representative of a teacher's union, would be, sure, private schools do better. Parents who have more money can send their kids to private schools. They are generally more advantaged. They have more exposure to the things that comprise knowledge.
And the reply to that assertion is that the unions have a special interest, of course, because they want to spend the maximum amount of money and minimize the class sizes, whereas in the private sector, the schools have to compete, and the parents have to pay twice, for once in tuition and once for taxes. They have to provide a superior education. And the thing that I'm a great admirer of private schools, again, both parochial and independent, is that they're able to provide a superior education at about half the cost.
Half the cost?
Half the cost.
Yeah. And we can also control for some of the other variables that you might think would influence the statistics. So you can control for the wealth of the parents and the educational attainment of the parents. And even when you control for that, when you compare apples to apples, the same kind of kids from the same background, you find very substantial gains for the private school kids. Test scores, graduation rates, the percent going on to higher education, even things like understanding civics. The private schools are doing a much better job teaching civics and citizenship than the public schools are.
Well, what has gone wrong? How is one really to account for that? How do we compare to nations like ourselves? Now, Canada is a neighboring nation with about the same level of wealth, much smaller population, but they're pretty much like us. Australia is kind of like us, though crucially different, at least with regard to the kind of beer they drink and how much of it they drink.
Because they don't actually drink Foster's down there.
No, they don't. That's an American Australian
which is a good
product.
Thing.
But, you know, what do we know? What are the national comparisons like?
Well, the United States does very poorly. You asked about Canada. They're intermediate between Europe and the United States, and the Asian countries do far better in general. If you think about some of the reasons for it, typically students in other countries go to school as much as 50% more. That is, numbers of days, hours, homework. And the Asian countries that have the highest test scores in the world also have private tutoring schools after school. So kids not only go to regular school during the week, but they go to school on Saturdays, and then they go to evening school for tutoring and special subjects as well. So just the amount of schooling they're getting is crucial to their success. And another thing is that you find in a great number of other countries is a standard curriculum, at least a core curriculum, and all the students are expected to know that so that the fourth grade teacher can depend on what the third grade teacher has taught. But other countries also have highly privatized systems compared to ours, and so that you have parochial schools and independent schools, and you don't necessarily have government providing the schools, even though they're financed by the government. So I would say that those are three major causes of why other countries have done better than the United States.
One contrary instance occurs to me. I think it's contrary. I wonder, you would know more about this than I do, but I'm thinking of the French lycée system, which is a public system. It's very centrally controlled by the Ministry of Education. And so the same curriculum, essentially, is taught in all French schools, equivalent to our elementary and middle schools. And indeed, they put in more time. Kids, I think, still go to school half a day on Saturday, as well as staying longer in school on the weekdays. But this is a government system, rather than there is a Catholic system, of course, which is separate, but in the main, the lycée system is government-controlled, government-ordered, government-manipulated, and the kids do very well.
Yes, and you need to make, we should talk about, make a distinction between government-supported, financially supported, which is true in much of Europe, or nearly all of Europe, including Holland and Denmark, for example, and also having a core curriculum that all students are expected to master. But also the governance of the school does not necessarily have to be public. In other words, the public institutions don't have to operate the schools, and there isn't that rigid segregation of public and private, but rather private institutions, including parochial and independent, can run the schools, and if they run them well, they attract more parents to send their children to the schools.
So you have this kind of unusual situation where in Europe you have a lot of choice and a lot of private education going on, but the higher education establishments, their universities all tend to be state-owned. There are very few private universities out there. So you come to the United States, we have all these government schools from the K to 12 level, but you have a lot of private higher education, a lot of choice and competition.
Do you in Western Europe have teachers' unions as strong as our teachers' unions?
Well, they have an ideology that is somewhat similar to ours, but they're not as powerful as they are in this country. And you do have in other countries around the world centralized examination systems so that you can compare one school with another and one student with another. There's a lot more accountability. So if a school is not doing well, the public knows about it. And that's just creeping into the public education system now, although the unions, of course, are dead against it. They don't want to be held accountable either in Europe or in this country.
There is a basic yes but that could be issued by many who are listening, some of them teachers, some of them representatives of particularly African-American sectors of the community. And that yes but is, you can't really, the schools aren't all that account for how well or how poorly kids learn. What accounts also, what controls a fair amount of the variance, is the stability of the home and the interest and capability of the parents to steer the kid in the right direction and develop the right attitudes in him or her regarding education itself. And we know that in America now, about half of the black population has got into middle-class life and middle-class levels. The other half is still essentially in inner-city culture, where there are no present fathers in most of the homes, where kids are born sometimes to 16 and 17-year-old girls, where in general there's heavy unemployment, a kind of culture in disorganization, long-running disorganization, which serves kids growing up in that setting quite poorly, so that they are not, they may even be stunted in terms of their nutritional inadequacy, or in terms of their need for a loving mentoring relationship with a stable, trustworthy parent. And all of that affects them even before they get to school. And then when they get to school, some of the least competent teachers have wound up in those schools. And therefore, if you don't get a lot of educational attainment, it's due to a deeper problem in the community or in the persisting American national culture. The problem of the unassimilated, culturally unassimilated portion of the American black community. And the problem with those schools is not in the schools. It's in the community. It's in the families. I want your response to all of that.
Well,
after we pause for these words. And we return to Herbert Wahlberg and Joseph Bast, the co-authors of the new book, Let's Put Parents Back in Charge. You want to say more about the purpose of putting this brief book together and its distribution and its relevance and how people can get their hands on it, for that matter. But I was talking about the dilemma of the inner city schools and the inner city student who, it is argued, can't really be helped. It's argued by some, can't be helped by any school system, though individual kids will break through. But on average, they are sort of shortchanged by life rather than merely by the school. But the school adds on the shortchanging as part of the continuing process. And Joe Bast has been doing, has a work in progress, titled The Case for School Choice in Illinois, within which you are reviewing some of the numbers concerning this very problem I've raised.
Right. We've got numbers for the Chicago Public Schools, the National Assessment of Educational Progress Statistics. This is the annual study that Herb Wahlberg mentioned earlier. 16% of eighth graders in Chicago read at a proficient level.
Only 16%.
Only 16%. Okay, 84% don't, according to the 2005 study. Among eighth grade black students, black eighth graders in Chicago, only 10% scored at proficient. Only 4% of black eighth grade students scored at proficient or above in the 2003 math test.
Okay. It sounds, well, that confirms the kind of thing I've been saying. Is that the fault of the schools or the fault of the culture?
Well, I think we shouldn't think about one cause or the other. I think we have to think about both causes, and it's well known that poverty explains a lot of the variation in student performance. And even when you look at poverty alone, you find that there isn't that much difference between blacks and whites. Poor whites in very difficult, adverse circumstances can do very badly as well, and particularly some of the things that go along with poverty, like single-parent homes and things of that nature and crime in the neighborhood. But I think what's really significant, Milt, is that schools can do something about it. The Public Trust has been doing, and a number of other groups have done that. I just recently reviewed about 10 studies of this kind, where they look at all of the schools in the whole country or within a state, and they say, are there any schools of very high poverty or high minority group status that score in the upper third of the distribution? And there are schools like that. The largest study that's ever been done by the Public Trust found that there were more than 1 million poor and minority students in schools where they were heavily concentrated and yet scored in the upper third of all schools within the state or within the country. So it is possible for some schools to overcome the problems of the neighborhood and the family.
What schools are overcoming the problems of the neighborhood?
Some of these are scattered throughout in rural areas, which we sometimes forget about. We're big city people, but they're in a variety of places. But typically the private schools do better, and in particular we have the best data on the schools that are the private schools that are most numerous, the Catholic schools. I think we'd probably find the same thing with Lutheran, Jewish, Orthodox, and others. But typically those schools do a better job, and they do it at as little as half the cost of the public schools. So it does show that schools are able to overcome to a large extent the adverse effects of poverty, particularly, Milt, when you look at it of a gain from 1 year.
Tell me this. Go into the classroom. Look through the curriculum. In Chicago, is there a difference in the curriculum pursued in the typical public school in the inner city and the typical Catholic parochial school in the inner city?
Well, the Catholic schools and private schools in general tend to get graduates that are not necessarily certified by conventional public school.
As teachers.
But they have a strong background in the liberal arts and sciences. Mm-hmm. And
Paid less as well.
They're paid a lot less, and they typically have larger classes, but they know their subject. And, I mean, it comes down to the obvious common sense idea that you can't teach what you don't know. Many of the teachers in big city systems don't have a fundamental mastery of the subject matter, which gives them a great handicap in their teaching.
And is there more stress put on certain subject matters in the parochial schools?
Historically, there certainly used to be. Chubb and Moe, for example, in their research, they found that Catholic schools were able to retain their core curriculum, whereas a lot of public schools had given up on that.
A core curriculum defined as what?
So more emphasis on math, history, science, and reading.
Geography. Did you mention science?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So fewer electives, more time on the basic stuff that we learned as we were growing up.
and less of the fluff designed to build self-esteem.
Yes,
I think so.
Has this self-esteem preoccupation of the educators persisted?
Well, you and I are psychologists, Milt, so we hate to be criticizing our own subject, but I think many educators have been taken in by what we might call pop psychology.
Absolutely.
As long as you're happy, everything is fine. Yeah. But the problem is you really have to work at something to be good at it, and I think happiness, I think engagement and hard work actually lead to that rather than the other way around.
Now, the two of you announced in a book that you did a few years ago, the book titled Education and Capitalism, How Overcoming Our Fear of Markets and Economics Can Improve America's Schools. What you were arguing essentially was, what's wrong with the public schools is that they're a socialist monopoly. And the answer to that is to let competition into the system once again, to restore an active competitive market, and that will transform the quality of the education that our kids get. Speaking of capitalism, we pause right now for some commercials. And when we come back, I want you to develop that thesis, not only as an argument, but then also there's a fair amount of evidence now that backs the argument. And let's hear that argument and the supportive evidence as we continue with Joseph Fast and Herbert Wahlberg after these words. And we return to Joseph Fast and to Herbert Wahlberg. And gentlemen, you can draw either from the new book, Let's Put Parents Back in Charge, or from the larger book of a few years ago, which I say again, is titled Education and Capitalism, How Overcoming Our Fear of Markets and Economics Can Improve America's Schools. That title, I think, Herb, is virtually a full statement of the thesis.
It is, very much so. We think that free markets, just as they work wonders in the various countries throughout the world, the capitalistic countries where people are free to trade with one another, are superior in terms of the welfare of the people that live within them. But even from, an ethical or moral standpoint, if I want to buy something from you and you want to sell it, it's a voluntary transaction, whereas the government is not forcing us to do it or interfering with us. Markets work magic, and we see that now if we contrast countries like North and South Korea, at Eastern and Western Europe, and we see the vitality now in places like India and China that are becoming more capitalistic, and people are doing so much better. And it's such an irony that we have such a bureaucratic government system in the United States for our schools when we are one of the most capitalistic countries in the world, and our industries are highly productive, highly capitalistic, highly competitive, and yet our schools are not, and the schools are obviously one institution that is not working well for us.
Would you want to call our school system socialistic or merely statist, or what? How would you categorize?
I think those are accurate terms. They are monopolies, you might say, or
government
monopolies. And there is very little choice. You have, you know, that you don't really have. Parents are not customers. They're, in most cases, they're stuck in going to a neighborhood school, whether they like it or not. And this is very unlike the situation in other countries throughout the world, where the school has to appeal to the parent.
You know, I must read something to you. We will be taking calls, of course, and email. But here's one email that's come in already, which is quite relevant to what you've just said. The former head of the American Federation of Teachers summed it up with disarming honesty. Quote, when students start paying union dues, I will start looking out for their interests. End quote. The outlook for primary education is hopeless as long as it is controlled by unions where pay and performance have no connection. Why on earth do teachers need a union? Why do politicians and taxpayers stand for this astonishing combination of incompetence and cynicism? Is our listener overstating the case?
I think it's a profound thought, but it's hardly original. Adam Smith said 200 years ago that the professors at Oxford and Cambridge worked from the endowments that were paid, and they should be paid by the students. If they were paid by the students, they would be much more responsive to what the students might like.
Do the unions then really exert a kind of stranglehold, or are they a barrier to the improvement of the quality of education?
I think the teacher unions are a huge problem. They're highly organized. They're well-funded. They spend millions of dollars a year on politics. They target elected officials who try to break the system with some type of school choice. So in the immediate here and now, the biggest barrier to school choice and school reform generally are teacher unions. But having said that, I don't think it's all that productive just to blame teacher unions. Teacher unions are a symptom of a bigger problem. Why aren't there big, powerful unions in other industries? I guess they are in automobiles, but now, you know, increasingly you can count them on one hand. They're like 12% now, I think, of the private workforce. But they're so big and they're so powerful in the public sector because there's no competition in the public sector. When the schools don't have to compete with one another, they can allow feather bedding, they can put up with incompetent staff members, they can create systems where it takes years to fire an incompetent teacher. None of that would be tolerated if you had a competitive system. So unions are a symptom of a monopoly enforced by the government in education. If we get rid of the monopoly, the unions then are disciplined by competition. They take their appropriate role in some areas and in some schools. That's a very positive, constructive role. We don't have to be anti-union to be pro-choice in education.
I think the other group that needs to be mentioned, though, in fairness, are school boards, because school boards should be representing the interest of the children, and they do not do that effectively. They don't have solid information, and they can't stand up to the unions, and so you could say that the unions are incredibly successful because they're essentially running the system.
Herbert Wahlberg, unions are a group that needs to be mentioned as a source of some of the constraint against improving the quality of education.
Absolutely.
School boards are another such group or constituency that might be mentioned. There is a third, and you should anticipate me on this. You belong to it, though. I think you're not typical of them, namely professors of education, schools of education.
Well, that is certainly true.
Teacher training institutions.
Yeah, I think that is a problem, because if you look at it from a more of an economic standpoint, any group will try to restrict membership, and it's been shown in a number of studies. By the way, you introduced me as professor. I'm emeritus professor now, so I can't take credit for being a professor anymore, and I'm a fellow at Hoover, but I don't have any teaching responsibilities, but I did for some 35 years. But in any case, I do think that there have been studies that have been shown that people in schools of education don't have often, or let's say on average, don't have the same kinds of liberal arts and science competency. That is mathematics, reading, literature,
and
civics,
and what
history.
I have in mind as well is the sort of theory of education, the principles of education,
yes,
their approach to pedagogy as conveyed to aspiring teachers.
Yeah.
They teach them to be far more sensitive to problems of aggression and self-doubt in class, and to be terribly curious about helping kids develop their sexual attitudes. And in general, they downplay, don't they, in the teachers' colleges, the acquisition of those skills which are commonly evident, Joe Bass was telling us a moment ago, in the parochial schools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and as Joe also mentioned earlier, the idea of self-esteem is a very big thing among many educators, and that's not going to help the child when they actually have to solve a mathematical problem or read a profound book.
Would it help American education if we closed down the schools of education in the universities where they flourish?
Well,
I think so. Maybe Professor Wahlberg is a little conflicted about that.
Yes, he was once one of them for a long time.
Well, I was for a long time.
There are a lot of alternative certification programs that allow people to teach without having to go through education courses, and they have great records. They're spreading all across the country.
Now, there's a crucial thing we must get to. There was once a little guy who lived in the same apartment house that we lived in, just off the campus of the University of Chicago. And he had some curious ideas about this very subject. His name was Milton Friedman, and he is, as much as anyone, I would suppose, the origin of the idea of the voucher system.
Exactly,
you know?
Right, yeah.
Let's
yeah.
talk about vouchers.
Milton Friedman wrote a book in 1962. It was published in 1962, Capitalism and Freedom. Yeah, in which one chapter was devoted to school reform. In that chapter, Milton Friedman proposed school vouchers. He said, take the money that currently goes to the schools and instead give it to parents in the form of a certificate or a scholarship or a voucher, and allow the parents then to choose whichever school they want for their child, public or private, and then use that scholarship or that certificate to pay for the tuition. That idea has rattled around now for going on 50 years, and it's gradually taking hold. We have, for example, in Florida, Wisconsin, Ohio, Vermont, and Maine all have programs that can be called voucher programs. A total of 635,000 kids now are attending private schools.
And we have a city nearby
tax support
that has a very active voucher
Milwaukee
system.
Is the leading leading city in the United States when it comes to vouchers. 15,000 kids, about 150 schools, are participating in that program. They just had a huge political battle because the program has been so successful that they've reached the cap on how many kids can participate. 15,000 kids, 15% of the total enrollment of the city. So the governor, the Democratic governor, has just agreed to raise the cap by 50% so that the program can continue to grow.
Now, the operation of a voucher system, the adoption of one, tends then to foster the invention of or the founding of private schools, I gather.
I think, Joe, we should probably mention, too, what are called private vouchers. This is the system in which wealthy individuals and firms give money to an organization, which in turn typically gives that money for scholarships to poor and minority kids to go to parochial and independent schools. And more than 50 cities in the United States have those programs. In fact, we have the Daniel Murphy Association here in Chicago, which has been in existence, I think, 10 or 15 years. And civic-minded, wealthy people give money to that so that poor kids can go to private schools. It's also, we should acknowledge, too, the huge demand for this. Something like 60% of Americans that have children would prefer to send their kids to private schools, and that number for African Americans is more like 80%. And, you know, the reason that that's true is that the unions are the most powerful in the big cities, and that's where you have the worst schools, and that's where the African Americans are concentrated.
Now, what's really the pileup of the relevant evidence? How strong is the evidence that a voucher system then fostering the establishment of private schools really produces higher increments of true educative attainment?
Herb and I have both been doing kind of summaries. In fact, we recently co-authored a piece in the Economics of Education Review or Research. I forget the title.
But I have, too. You're talking about the journal article or the book?
The peer-reviewed article.
And
a lot of research has been done. One of the neat things about a lot of the current voucher programs and charter school programs is that the kids are assigned to the schools by lottery. More parents want kids in these schools than there are seats for the kids. So as a result, you can do a controlled experiment. You can follow the academic achievement of the kids who didn't get into the charter school or the voucher school versus those that did. And that then controls for parental motivation, income, a lot of other various things that might have otherwise made measurement impossible. And these studies, they find significant positive effects of the school choice programs, of vouchers or charter schools. No study has found a negative effect of school choice. Some of them don't find much statistically significant effect at all. Complicating the situation is when a kid moves from one school to another, he oftentimes, there's an achievement decline because he has to reacclimate himself to the school. The curriculum is different, the expectations are different, he doesn't have his friends, and there's also a lot of churning in these schools. Pilot voucher programs typically are in the lowest income neighborhoods, so you've got families that are transient, and kids might only be in the program for 2 or 3 years, and then they leave, so there's a lot of attrition going on. But the best research that we've seen, and Herb might want to add to this, finds that school choice programs, where they exist, benefit all students, and in particular low-income and minority students.
Now, if the head of the research division of the National Education Association were sitting with us right here at this table tonight, what would he or she say in response?
Well, in fact, they have done that because there are what are called education management organizations in the United States, like Edison Schools, for example, and National Heritage Schools, and some of that research has been brought together. Independent studies indicate a superiority of these for-profit, interestingly enough, education management organizations, but the union studies indicate that the private schools are doing worse, or let's say the voucher schools or charter schools are doing
worse.
Well,
how do they develop different numbers?
As Aristotle said, we have to consider the source. They may have different motivations, and obviously the unions are hostile towards competition, and if they can minimize it, the research indicates what they wanted to indicate. One or two points that Joe didn't mention that I think are important is the demand for getting into these schools. For example, in the charter schools in Chicago, nearly every single one is oversubscribed. One of the reasons you can do experiments and you can have a lottery to find out who'll determine who will go to the school, which students will go and which won't, is that so many parents would like to send their kids there.
By the way, Herb, you're mentioning charter schools suggests to me that we need to do a little footnote or sidebar defining what a charter school is and how it relates to the voucher system.
Yes, in the case of the charter school, money is given to the school organization. The school has to apply to a public entity such as depending on where they are, but typically to the school board. The school board may allow a private group to run the school.
But it is officially part of the public school system.
It's part of the public school system. It's government funding, but it has a private board. Whereas a voucher, the money goes directly to the parent, and the parent can spend that money at any legitimate but minimal regulations and so on. You want to have safety and non-discrimination and things of that nature. So there is a difference between the voucher and the charter.
So charter schools are kind of a halfway measure toward parental choice.
Yes,
it gives some of the flexibility of a private school. And because they get paid based on how many kids choose to be there, how many parents choose that school, there's more competition, choice, and accountability than you get in a traditional public school.
And do you tend to get differences in what they teach in the charter schools?
One of the claims
and
for
how
charter
will they
schools,
teach?
And I think it's a justified claim, is that you do have more innovation and you have private boards that try to interject more accountability. And generally speaking, the charter schools have done a little bit better. And in no case do they do worse. I mean, if you take the large-scale studies, you can find some rotten charter schools, and you can find some wonderful ones. So on average, they've done slightly better. And it is, according to the theory of the charter school, there's typically a five-year charter. And if you haven't performed well, the state or the city is supposed to close you down.
Have some been gone through that life cycle?
Not as much as they should have. And in fact, now this applies to all public schools in the United States because of the federal legislation called No Child Left Behind. Mm-hmm. And if you failed for a given number of years, you have to be subject to some sort of restructuring, such as letting the staff go or converting to a charter school.
Herb, say something, if only briefly, about the charter school of whose board I gather you are president.
Yes. No, I'm not the president. I'm a founding member of the Chicago International Charter School, or we sometimes also call our group the Chicago Charter School Foundation. And we happen to be here right here in the city, and we're the largest, we think, charter school in the United States. We've got 6,000 kids on nine campuses, and we offer a college preparatory program. And it's been a wonderful experience for me to serve on that board.
It hasn't been a wonderful experience for the kids. How do we demonstrate that?
Well, actually, my friend Carolyn Hoxby at Harvard, at my invitation, did an independent study of our school, and she showed that in the first 5 years of our existence, with the lottery idea, and also with extremely sophisticated econometric techniques, showed that our kids were scoring better. And, of course, we also are very much concerned about looking at waiting lists, and we have lots of parents who would like to send their kids to our schools. Being fair, though, is my understanding is that nearly every single charter school in the city is oversubscribed. So there's a lot of demand for it, and there are limited. Illinois is not a pioneering state with respect to choice like Milwaukee and Wisconsin. We have very restrictive laws, and it's hard to get a charter, and often charter applications are turned down, so it abridges, and partly because of union pressure, and partly because school boards don't want to admit to competition either. So Illinois is not, I would say, Illinois and Chicago are not the pioneering places that Florida, Milwaukee, and other locations.
In 2 minutes, before we pause for some commercials and then on to a newscast and shortly on to the phone calls, would you, Joe Bast, give me your own candid evaluation of the quality of the Chicago school system right now and of its management right now?
Oh, I think it's horrible, absolutely horrible. For the last 10 years, we've been told that things are getting better. Under Mr. Vallis and now under Arne Duncan, You know, virtually once a week, there's some notice, some announcement of some new experiment or program or reform in the Chicago public schools. Every tiny increase in test scores, 1 or 2 points, gets treated as some tremendous progress. In fact, you know, 90% of our kids aren't proficient at math and reading. I mean, this is tremendous. Only one kid in 10 is actually learning how to read and write and do calculations in our schools. It's not getting any better. You know, we can play with the numbers, we can try to get rid of waste and fraud, but the school system is bouncing along the bottom. It's a travesty, and we need to do some pretty major changes if we're going to improve that system.
As, among other possibilities, introduce
more school choice.
More absolutely. School choice, more voucher.
More charter schools, start a voucher program, a pilot voucher program for low-income kids. We've got a great model right to the north of us. Why can't we do what Milwaukee is doing?
Well said and strongly said. We will look for a reaction on 591-7200. That's the phone number. Or via email, extension 720 at tribune.com. We're ready for your contributions, whether in the form of questions or reports or arguments. 591-7200, and we'll be directly back after this. And we return to Joseph Bast and to Herbert Wahlberg, and shortly onto your calls and emails for them. Again, the phone number 591-7200. And if you are listening at some greater distance and listening over the internet, for that matter, if you're listening in Japan, where apparently they do some kinds of education much better than we do, according to comparative studies done by people like Johnson and Stigler and many others. And you want to get to us from Tokyo or Osaka, the best way, of course, is via email, extension 720 at tribune.com. And that's certainly for the ladies who are listening down in Sydney, Australia, today at around 1 o'clock in the afternoon, or tomorrow at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And we'll be with you very shortly, both by phone and by email, but a little bit more directly about this volume that I have in front of me. Let's put parents back in charge, or as I tried to say earlier, pongamos a los padres nuevamente a cargo. Who's it intended for? What is it intended to do?
Well, you do have lots and lots of Hispanics here in Chicago, but also in other parts of the United States, and many of them who would like to go to private schools, particularly Catholic schools. So this has a capacity to reach them, and there's a great deal of interest in privatization among Hispanic parents.
So the idea was to create a small outreach publication. This is a little booklet, very inexpensive. In fact, we give them away for free. If anybody wants copies, just contact the Heartland Institute. The new volume, or the new edition of it, is one half in Spanish, one half in English. And it essentially makes the case for putting parents back in charge of their kids' education.
What's the point of contact with the Heartland Institute?
You can call us at 312-377-4000. It's 312-377-4000. Or you can go to our website, which is www.heartland.org. Heartland, as in the heartland of America.
To be sure.
.org.
And gentlemen, with that, let us go to the phones. And there are some good email messages as well that have accumulated and which I will be reading shortly. But here is the first caller. On 591-7200. Good evening.
Hello?
Yes, sir.
Yes. Thanks for taking the call. I retired in June. I was a junior high teacher in one of our affluent suburbs up north for 34 years. And about the first two-thirds of my career were in a performance-based merit system. And the last portion of it, we then unionized, and I thought I might give you some insight into the pros and cons of it, at least from my perspective.
Yes, go ahead, please.
When I first interviewed and got the job up there, I thought it was a terrific idea. But unfortunately, the reason that teachers ultimately worked against the merit system was because it was somewhat random. The people who made the decisions about your salary were not experienced necessarily in your subject areas. I remember that after 3 years, after I had tenure, they would observe me once a year and then determine what my salary would be for the next year. Another thing that happened with the system, which I think in theory is great, is that they used it to, to punish people who had different ideas from those espoused by the administration. So I think, I think in theory it's a great idea, but it really didn't seem to work.
Was this a Catholic parochial school?
No, this was a public school.
It was a public school?
Yes.
And the system ended how long ago?
Oh, I want to say, was I under contract 12 or 14 years?
Mm-hmm. Well, an interesting contribution. Let's get some response.
Well, I think the first thing to be said about it is extremely unusual. It's very rare to have anything like that at all. So it was a relatively untested system. But the logic having no accountability, if we applied that to the manufacturing of automobiles or radios or television or you name it, if we didn't have any merit pay and people were not rewarded for better performance, the other reason why that merit pay is so terribly important is we have a huge shortage of science and mathematics teachers these days. And if we don't pay them more money, we're not going to be able to get them. And these are two absolutely vital subjects. So there are abuses of any kind of a system, and you would find that in business as well. But in the end, it's the preferred system.
And you don't get a perfect fix with any system. What I'm thinking of as this interesting call has come through is university systems and the institution of tenure.
Mm-hmm.
The fact is, there is merit evaluation when you're untenured in the role of instructor, though that position hardly exists anymore, but then assistant professor, usually for 6 years, and then you're going to get promoted up or you're going to get eased out. It's the up or out time, whether you go to associate professor with tenure or whether you're told, sorry, not here, go get a job someplace else. Does that usually essentially respond to the merit of the untenured faculty? It does, but not with perfect coordination.
Yeah, it's not perfect because it can be politicized, and sometimes groups will make poor decisions. But not only is it true in universities, but law firms are that way, accounting firms are that way. You make partner or
mm-hmm.
you don't make partner.
Yeah.
And that's not the end of it. You have to continue to perform. At most universities, they still have a merit pay system. And if you publish significant books
yes.
and you do a good job of teaching, you get a bigger merit increase than
yeah.
you would.
And you get appointed to more of the prestige committees.
Yes.
But they don't fire you if you turn unproductive after you get tenure.
Yeah, that's one of the wonderful things that we enjoy, isn't it, Milt?
It's one of the terrible things that you enjoy. Yeah.
That's how they keep, or even if you give gross offense,
uh-huh.
just consider the case of Arthur Butz, the Holocaust denier, who's a professor of engineering at Northwestern University, and a great embarrassment to the administration of the university. He's frozen as associate professor,
mm-hmm.
but associate professor with tenure.
Mm-hmm.
591-7200, our number, as we go to the next caller. Good evening.
How are you, Milt?
Fine, thank you.
Okay. I have a question for your gentleman guests.
Number yes.
one, has anyone, either one of them, ever done research at a Chicago public school, primary research, upon which to base their, evidence in their writings, or have they relied upon others' research?
Well, I think, Herb, you've done lots of research.
I have, yeah.
Chicago public schools.
Yes, I have, going back to 1962, but these figures that Joe mentioned
mm-hmm.
are from a recent national study.
But have either one of you actually spent, let's say, a month's worth of time, studying what goes on in any of the Chicago public school systems? Because personally, I think that if you're going to be a researcher, it's always best to depend on your own, primary sources of information rather than relying on others.
Ma'am, I ask you a question. Are you associated with the Chicago schools?
I have been indeed teaching for 17 years, and I've been listening to what the gentleman callers have been saying. And my background is history. I have my BA and my MA in history, and we always focus very strongly on doing your own primary research whenever you're writing any papers or, you know, conducting research. You don't rely on others. Number one, you have to have primary research you do yourself. It has to be updated.
Let me interrupt you to ask you quite directly, because I think you're circling this, but I'm sure you've got a response to the following. What is your reaction to what you've heard tonight?
Well, I'm trying to be very, you know, professional, and I've gone to public schools. I teach in public schools, but I was actually in the parochial school system myself. Mm-hmm. I got my education there. And I do not understand how the gentleman can sit here and, you know, yes, both schools have, you know, minority students. They have students from, you know, rather low-income background, the parents anyway. But the difference is that, personally speaking, as I know myself, the students that go to parochial schools, when they return home, they have two parents generally. And these parents may not have a lot of money, but they care greatly about education, enough to collect their pennies and send their children to schools where they know that, number one, you know, everyone is no-nonsense about education. They stick to the basics, and if anyone's going to be less than serious about their education, they're out. Now, let's take a trip to the Chicago public schools. Most of the students go home. They're lucky if they have a grandmother there. There's no one there to help them with their homework. There's no one that cares. The only one that cares are the teachers at school. And yet they're always lambasted by these so-called experts. We at our school have taken in people from non-educational background to come in and teach. You don't want to see what goes on in their classrooms. I'll give you an example today, okay? And this entire week and last week, no one is supposed to leave before the end of the day. If you look at our school, 20 minutes before departure and the bell rings, there are students coming from this gentleman's room, streaming out into the hall. He doesn't call them and say, students, where are you going? The bell hasn't rung. He just lets them walk out. Now, how is this improving the quality of education?
Well, you know, we have to go to commercials in just a moment,
okay,
but let's get
you.
A response. Sure. Very interesting contribution indeed. Joe Best.
Well, I think, first of all, you have to teach your kids the difference, your students, the difference between anecdotes and data, and being in a classroom doing your own research, as you put it, can be very valuable. But that doesn't contradict national databases of studies. We're looking at thousands, even millions of students and accepted standardized test scores, and they don't lie.
But with all due respect, we're ignoring the issue, the essential issue, that true education starts from the home.
No, we're not denying that at all.
What
we're doing is saying that you can objectively measure outputs and you can measure them across large numbers of students. And that's
again,
the data that Professor Wahlberg and I have been reporting.
With all due respect, you're ignoring the, you know, you're not answering my question. How can a child who, you know, every day they go home, generally, you know, they're lucky to have an aunt, you know, that they can stay
you
with.
You see, we've presented data on that, too. When you control for socioeconomic status, we can control for whether they have one parent or two, and the income and the educational attainment.
Ma'am, I trust you will excuse me, but I fear we do have to pause right now.
Sure, okay.
But I thank you for a very interesting contribution.
I thank you so much.
Good night for now.
Thank you.
I want to read you an email I've got here, and then we're going to stop for some commercials. But this will certainly require some response from you. And it's a little bit longish, but it's relevant. And here goes. Another program criticizing education. Right now, the abilities of public school teachers. I say that point of view is ridiculous. As a teacher, understand, I know that we are educated, that we do know our subject areas, that we work hard, and besides this, we are monitored continuously by the Chicago Board of Education. No one ever says what's really wrong with the inner city high schools. There's something wrong with the kids in our society which produces these kids. They're rude and crude. They swear constantly. They're obnoxious, disrespectful, argumentative, angry, full of themselves, and violent. They don't want to learn, and they do their best to undermine the teacher's efforts by constant talking and clowning around. They won't listen. They think they're grown and know everything already. They don't accept the teacher's expertise, and they resent any correction. For example, they don't want the English teacher to make any corrections on their papers. They're focused on sex, drugs, gangs, and rap music. The bottom line is that they don't value education. I say let them leave the system after eighth grade. put them in mandatory work programs, e.g. sweeping the streets, and only let them come back when they're ready to learn. Period. I look forward to your response after these words. And we return to Joseph L. Bast and Herbert J. Wahlberg. Joe Bast is the president and CEO of the Heartland Institute, which is a very significant independent and nonprofit research operation here in Chicago. And Herb Wahlberg is research professor, as he insists, emeritus, that means retired, of education and psychology at the University of Illinois at Chicago, and is a non-retired visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. And they are the co-authors, earlier, of a major book, Education and Capitalism, How Overcoming Our Fear of Markets and Economics Can Improve America's Schools, and of the new, shorter book, intended for a general audience, obviously, Let's Put Parents Back in Charge, and also a Spanish version. They are published in one volume. And you have a response, Herb, to the blast from that last email.
Yes, in fact, I'd like to respond to the caller as well. The caller seemed to be on weak ground because she had a private education herself and yet seemed to react negatively to allow other people to have a private education. So I think that is very significant. I think you made the point earlier that poverty is a major problem in big cities, Milt, so nobody's arguing with that. Again, I ask that we have, again, two teachers that are critical of allowing more choice in the system. Well, if those students, according to the person who wrote that, are so difficult, why deny them the opportunity to go to someplace else that might be more successful, that might have a different kind of program that would be more appealing to them?
Am I correctly informed that one charter school operating in Chicago now is a military school?
I had heard that that had been proposed. I'm not sure whether it went forward or not.
Some of the kids that teacher describes might do well in the military
school. It's conceivable. What we need, I think, is not just choice, but we need more variety because different students like different programs. We don't want all universities to be the same, for example.
See, if I might just add a quick thing.
Yes, please.
I was also struck. There are kids like the kids described in that message that are unruly and mouth off to the teachers and don't want to be there. But there have always been kids like that. For the 100 years, parents and teachers have lamented that the kids don't want to learn, that they don't come to school prepared to learn, that they're exhausted because they've been working in the fields all day before they get to the school, or they head for the fields afterwards, or they're malnourished. So blaming the parents and blaming the kids is a common practice. We've heard the same stuff over and over again for 50 years. Good schools don't make excuses. There are good charter schools, there are good Catholic schools that are taking the very same kids who are failing in public schools and turning them around. And they're doing it with high expectations and strong discipline and decent curriculum.
They usually put them in uniforms as well.
And they put them in uniforms. And it's not because they kick out of school the kids who don't take schooling seriously. The public schools do that. They have a dropout rate of 40-50%. That's kids who are being disinvited from school, who are being told don't bother coming back. The Catholic schools and generally the private schools have much lower dropout rates. They're trying to keep these kids, and they're putting them in an environment where the kid wants to learn and straighten himself out.
Back to the phones, gentlemen. 591-7200. And you are next on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Yes, sir.
I'm calling from Milwaukee, Wisconsin. I have a few comments to make about choice and voucher schools.
Yes.
In Milwaukee, the choice schools allow children to cross political boundaries. In other words, kids from the suburbs can come into the city and vice versa. Now, to make that attractive, especially to the kids in the suburbs, we have what we call target schools, which are high schools that are geared toward the arts, towards college prep, towards business and trade and technical. And that program seems to be working out fairly well, because ordinarily you wouldn't think that kids from the suburbs would want to come into the city, especially since they come from a much a background that is economically much better than. Then another comment I have to make is that the unions, both local and the state in Wisconsin, are dead set against all of these programs. And one thing that I think they are hypocrites, because in the city of Milwaukee, the public school teachers must live in the city. I read in our local newspaper here about a week or so ago that 23% of these teachers send their children to private schools, but yet they want to deny the right of other people to do the same thing. And I just find that abominable. I really do. Rick, I'd like to hear your comments on this.
By all means, gentlemen.
Yeah, I would like to say be careful not to brand all teachers by the positions that the teacher union leaders are taking. So probably 40-50% of teachers are Republicans or call themselves conservatives or say that they support school choice. It's the leadership of the teacher unions that have singled out school choice and vouchers and are leading the campaign against it.
Let me take the opportunity, Milt, to congratulate this caller on being from Milwaukee. I think we're fortunate to be close by. I think Wisconsin's one of the really pioneering states, particularly the city of Milwaukee, for increasing choice and being very bold in doing it. And as a matter of fact, just in the last few days, the Education Committee of the Legislature ruled that, submitting legislation to the full legislature that will allow the university system to have charter schools. So there can be a connection between the elementary high schools and the 13 or so campuses within the state of Wisconsin. I consider this a highly innovative program and look forward to future things of constructive from that state.
And we thank you, sir, for the call.
You're welcome.
A valuable contribution, and we go to the next. Hello, you're on the air.
Thank you. Milt, I appreciate you having this discussion. I don't necessarily agree with your callers, I mean the people you have on, totally, but I do think it's necessary to have this discussion because I think education does need to be addressed. The couple of questions I have with it, one of your gentlemen, I'm not sure which one, has reputedly said that private schools have been able to provide an education at half the cost of the public schools, and yet they talk about their factors. They have not yet one time mentioned the fact that special education is a factor in what they're doing. I just want to hear them address that because it's an enormous cost for the public schools, which the private schools do not have to address because they don't take them. They don't have to take them, and they don't take them. In fact, I have children here, and I'm from Peoria, Illinois, who went to private schools, and they had a child with Down syndrome who could not go to a private school because the school can cut them off. And yet you talk about the fact that they don't have to kick them out. They absolutely do kick them out. The private schools here absolutely kick them out, and they go to the public schools. And the public schools have to take them. And so I find the data questionable when you make those kind of cost comparisons because I don't think that's a valid comparison. You're not comparing apples to apples.
Very interesting, and a point well made. What do private schools, and for that matter charter schools, do with kids who ordinarily would require special ed assignment?
Laws in most states require that charter schools take any comer. The only way that they can reject students is by lottery. You must take anyone that comes, and that includes special education. About the cost issue, I happen to have been an expert witness in a dispute between the city of New York and the state of New York, and I did one of several studies that have been made of the cost of Catholic schools versus public schools. So what we did is to subtract out all of the students that were in special education from both public and parochial schools, and also subtracted out certain other things that the public schools claim that they have to have, such as transportation, food services, and things of that nature. And the cost of the parochial schools were 46% of that of the public schools. And in addition to that, the parochial schools had much higher achievement than the public schools, particularly for those schools that had the very highest levels of poverty. In addition to that, the McKay scholarships in Florida allow special education families to send their kids with a voucher to private schools. It's a very innovative program. And while the achievement hasn't been analyzed, the special education, and when I say special education, by the way, that includes deaf and blind children, but also mild mental retardation, special learning disabilities, behavior disorders, and so on. The parents of the special education children were much happier when they were allowed the opportunity to have a program in a private school. Some of them were specialized special education schools, and others were simply charter schools or regular private schools.
I have one other question, if I could, Mel.
Go ahead, sir.
Just real quickly, you've talked about there had been, at least I think 2 years ago, a number of scandals in the Milwaukee system, which you've not mentioned at all about the charter schools, because there was totally unregulated kind of system on the charter schools of people who could file the charter school to go with that. And there were two felons who started charter schools in Milwaukee. bilked millions of dollars out of the system and stuff with it. Yet all you've done has just been just, you know, say the Milwaukee system is this model and it's this thing with it. I'm just questioning what, and I'm not saying that charter schools are necessarily wrong, because I do think there's a role for charter schools, and I think they do, especially in the inner cities, because I think there is a real problem with public schools in the inner cities. And
here's a response from Joe Bass.
You're right. There have been scandals with voucher schools and charter schools up in Milwaukee. Same thing with public schools in Milwaukee, and same thing with public schools in Chicago. In fact, in the newspapers for the last week, there's been cases of felony fraud in the public schools where a principal was diverting $400,000 in cash over the last 2 years from her school. The neat thing about charter schools and voucher schools is when stuff like that happens, they get closed down. Whereas in the public schools, they just keep going year after year. We're just barely seeing the tip of the iceberg of fraud and abuse and corruption in the public schools, whereas any time it's found in the charter schools and in the voucher schools, it's on the front pages of the newspapers, and those schools get shut down.
And with that, sir, we'll consider that a fair exchange. Let me read you an interesting email here. titled, Capitalism in Schools. Capitalism spelled... C-A-P-I-T-O-L-I-S-M. I cannot understand how the idea of applying a capitalist model to our schools is actually supposed to work. With capitalism, someone is supposed to be making a profit. So are your guests suggesting that our schools should be able to make a profit? If so, who gets to keep the profits? The principals? The teachers? And are taxpayers going to like the idea that their tax money is being given to someone as profit? The basic principle of capitalism doesn't make sense for public schools, because schools are not for profit, meaning that rather than making money, their interest is controlling costs. The way organizations control costs, quite often, is by paying employees less, meaning teachers, which leads us right back to where we started.
Well, I think this is deceptive in many, from several different angles, but I think I should give my colleague a chance to answer this, Joe.
yeah, it's fascinating. Just because an organization makes a profit doesn't mean that there's less money available for teachers or in the classroom. In fact, it's probably just the opposite. Profits are signals to direct the investment of resources. They tell us whether we're doing something right or not doing it right, if we're as efficient as we can be. When an institution is driven by profit, it's likely to be more efficient and more productive than a system that's non-profit, because the incentive structures are going to be right. People are going to be paid more if they do the right thing and less if they do the wrong thing. Waste won't be tolerated. In a non-profit environment, in a monopoly environment like the public schools, you can get teachers who are completely unproductive, who shouldn't be in the classroom, who will nevertheless stay on year after year after year with tenure protection. You don't see that in private schools, and you don't see that in for-profit schools, because it's not profitable to do that. So I think profit has an entirely proper place in education. I think it could produce genuine results and dramatic improvements. And the whole phrasing of this objection points to, I think, the failure of our public schools to educate people about just what capitalism is and how it works.
I'd like to supplement Joe's answer with the original metaphor that Milton Friedman used in proposing this radical idea some half century ago. And he said that you should think of schools like restaurants. If you had a restaurant that was very, very expensive and had very, very bad food, it would have to close down. But that's exactly the situation that we have in public education. So what we're suggesting is the schools need to be more like restaurants, where there's an owner, a proprietor, who benefits when he serves people well and more people want to go to his school and, in fact, go there. So they will expand, and the just as you would find restaurants in Chicago, is something with statistics or something like one out of every five restaurants can survive for 3 to 5 years because of the competition that's engendered.
And that says something about why advertisers rush to get on this program. And it's time to hear from them once again, and then directly back to Joe Bast and Herbert Wahlberg, and back to your calls and emails. If you've been trying to reach us by telephone, we've now got a few lines available at last, 591-7200. And directly back to Joe Bast and Herb Wahlberg, and back to your calls to them on 591-7200. You are on the air. Good evening.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I live in Naperville, and I contend this idea that we don't have a capitalist system. I choose to live in Naperville, which has some of the finest schools in the world. I pay higher property taxes to live in Naperville, so my kids go to the finest, some of the finest schools in the world. You're going to tell me that people aren't making these decisions based on money and based on capitalism, that it's a social system where wealth is distributed evenly and everybody has the same resources, and it's not socialism, it's capitalism at the core.
You mean good schools in the suburbs and bad schools in the inner city is capitalism at the core?
No doubt about it. And you know, I went to a parochial school when I was a kid, and there was many kids kicked out and wound up in public schools who were discipline problems. Mm-hmm. If the nuns couldn't deal with it, they were out the door.
I have a friend who runs Driscoll High School out in the suburbs. I don't know if you're familiar with it. Driscoll is a Catholic high school, and most of their kids were kicked out of the public high school down the street because they have drugs and gang problems at the public school. And so the parents say, I got to get my kid into a better disciplinary environment, so they put him in the Catholic school. I think there's a lot of kids moving back and forth between public and private schools, and I don't think it means that the private schools are kicking out the misbehaving kids.
Well, I think what our caller is saying is that he's made a capitalist choice because he's got the money to buy the better product. Mm-hmm. He buys it not by sending the kid to a private school, but by moving the family to a suburb that has better public schools.
Yes, so, and I think many people do that. I think people who can afford to will either send their kids to, if we're talking about Chicago, but also other big cities in the United States, will send their kids to independent schools or parochial schools if they can afford it and they don't want to make the long commute. But if they can't, they would move to a suburb. And I agree with the caller. Naperville has a fabulous reputation, but not everyone can afford to move to Naperville.
Exactly.
And so that's the constraint. We're concerned here mostly with inner city kids. So that's where the problem is.
Well, we're concerned with fairness and with efficiency, and also with the social problems that occur when low-income parents are stuck with the worst schools. So those three problems aren't addressed by saying wealthy people can move out to the suburbs and finance their own school systems. There ought to be a much more efficient, much more fair way of doing it, and one would think school choice fits that recipe.
I've got to read you this. It's a little longish, and I may edit it a bit, but I'm listening to two school reform advocates as I'm typing this. In my opinion, the school system stinks because the system is actively working against putting good teachers into the classroom. At the age of 42, I decided to become a full-time teacher after 20 years as a newspaper reporter and considerable experience teaching in community colleges part-time and considerable volunteer experience that netted me local and national awards. Although I graduated college, I had to take 12 ridiculously easy undergrad courses before taking one grad school course. Despite being a full-time reporter for 20 years with thousands of clips, I had to take 2 introduction to writing classes. Altogether, I have 19 A's in 19 subjects since returning to school, with A's in about 100 tests in a row. But I have less chance of being hired than a 21-year-old with a 2.01 grade point average. In the 100 hours I have observed schools, I've learned that public school teachers are amazingly ignorant about the subjects they teach, and private school teachers have no idea how to teach. They just lecture. I still can't teach. I only needed to student teach when the grad school decided I needed to take 5 more history courses, although they informed me in writing that I had to take 0 more when I was admitted. My younger classmates were not required to take those very same courses, although almost every one of them failed the statewide history test, while I scored 93 on the history test and 91 on the social studies test 3 years ago. This is rather like a legal brief after a while, without having taken a course in 15 years. Sitting in the education classes was frustrating because the students were amazingly ignorant. In addition, I have a 3.5 GPA in the 20 history and social studies classes I've taken in my life at an Ivy League caliber school. The bottom line is that the educational establishment does not give a damn about hiring qualified teachers. Sorry for venting.
Well, I think this is very true. I think many excellent people who would make wonderful teachers are denied the opportunity. Yeah. And obviously, if this man or woman had a lot of experience in writing, that's exactly what we need. And actually, that's one of the huge advantages private schools have, because they can hire people who are competent in their subject, or and especially for a prime skill like writing, when we have so few people that can write these days. There is a new movement to get around this, and that is that you don't certify by the number of education courses, but rather examination systems. And you have to pass tough exams in fields like mathematics, reading, civics, history, geography, and other subjects, plus an examination on effective, efficient pedagogy as well. And through an examination system like that, people can become more rapidly certified.
We are going to the next caller on 591-7200 in just a moment. 591-7200. But first, we pause for our last round of commercials. And directly back to the phones, here is the next caller. Hello, you're on the air.
Hello, Professor Rosenberg. This is Hawk from University of Illinois. I've been listening very attentively. I think one of the problems that we are not talking about are the course content, the curriculum, the fragmentation of knowledge. The students are really, really so dazzled by all the bits and pieces they get, and so are the teachers. I don't think we need to blame the teachers. We need to really look into why knowledge is so fragmented that nobody can put the Humpty Dumpty back together. There used to be a reading list that Oshkosh school system used to put out, I think 100 books that one could read. Parents used to be part of that system. Parents have been booted out, basically. I think parents need to put together a listserv of their own so they could interact with each other. And some of the problems basically that have been talked about, we are measuring numbers. We are saying that the one caller called that Naperville schools are better. I think they need to look at it. Something that glitters doesn't necessarily mean it's gold. Mm.
Is it not the case, and I put this particularly to Herb Wahlberg, that in the private schools and even charter schools involve parents a good deal more in the planning of the school program?
Oh, very much so, because they have to please the parents. Otherwise, the parents can walk away. Whereas
they're the customers.
Absolutely.
Yeah, but I think it still boils down to, which is good, which is very good. I'm so glad to hear that. But the best thing that we need to look into is the curriculum. The course content, the books that I go to many schools in the Chicago area, the kind of books they are being exposed to, the teachers, is so fragmented.
Well, you know, sir, you are a university teacher, so is Herb Wahlberg, and so am I, and have been for a long time. And I would argue that what you say is also equally applicable to the curricula of various universities and colleges. In
Absolutely.
Fact, in general, the core basic content of Western civilization has been honored more in the breach than in the observance in college teaching. We've thrown a good deal of the core away for more fashionable and easier and more entertaining courses.
Absolutely. That's what I am...
And more ideological courses
yes,
as well.
Yes, well, that's why my main theme is we need to integrate knowledge, bring back knowledge. The more we integrate it, the more it shrinks. Because really over the last 5,000 years, if we really integrate it and sort it out, we haven't really learned all that much.
Mm-hmm.
It looks too much, but if we integrate it, it becomes very manageable and very, very much possible to our students.
Thank you, sir, for the call. Interesting comment.
It was an interesting comment, and I have a good friend, E.D. Hirsch, Don Hirsch, who wrote Cultural Literacy, who's
Indeed.
Made a similar argument, and that our students not only do poorly on the international surveys of science and mathematics, but they have a very, very poor understanding of civics, history, and geography, which are subjects closest to being an educated American. And if you don't have a mastery of this core knowledge, you can't even participate in the civic life in this country or understand allusions to literary works.
And as you know, because I've told you often, and because I've told this audience often, I have done a cultural literacy quiz with students at the University of Chicago on and off for many years, usually on the last day of the large lecture class, so they won't get after you after the test has been administered, and find usually distressingly low levels of common information. Juniors and seniors at the University of Chicago who can't tell you, as most of them can't, the dates of the American Civil War, the capital of Finland. These are actual items used. What French king, was executed during the French Revolution, the title of a novel by Saul Bellow, etc., etc. To which the response is, that doesn't matter. That's just information. You can get it on the Internet. But it does matter because, as your friend Hirsch, who's been on this program, has argued so well, that's correlate with a general sophistication as you function in this world. And you can't really understand the stuff that's coming in unless you've got this informational base.
Absolutely. And it's such a, so ironic, too, Milt, because the University of Chicago is famous for having a core curriculum, and it's really an elite institution.
Well, as you know, there's been a struggle at the University of Chicago in recent years about reducing the core.
Yeah.
And they have whittled the core down just a bit.
Yeah, so if you had that kind of performance at the University of Chicago, what's it like at Slippery Rock State Teachers College in Arkansas?
Of course, we do still have a great books college in the Midwest, Scheimer College.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
The president of Scheimer was on this program only a few weeks ago.
Seriously? Yes. William Rice.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And you know they are moving into Chicago proper.
Indeed.
At IIT campus.
Yeah. Yeah. They will become the liberal arts college for IIT, which is wonderful. So we'll finally have an undergraduate college back here in Chicago that focuses on the great books.
And, gentlemen, we go back to the phones. 591-7200, and you are on the air. Good evening.
Oh, hi. Thank you for having me on today, Mill.
Yes, sir.
The problem that I have, I guess, with what these people are saying is twofold. I look at the examples of places like Evanston and Highland Park, both of which, in their school systems, have obviously maniacal parents who've chosen to be there. I guess I'm one of them, because here I am, doing my best to bring down the average income levels here. But they also have large minority communities that really don't have as much of a choice as to where they are. And these schools seem to do a reasonable job of educating their kids. And the question is, you know, all of the kids, they may not do as good a job with students that are in worse backgrounds than those who are with maniacal backgrounds at home. But the point is that if you can do it in a suburb, then what's the reason that it doesn't happen in the city? The answer would seem to be the people. The parents that are going to demand higher quality teachers are going to demand higher quality teachers, and that's going to benefit everyone who's there. So isn't the real solution to try to find a way to get better quality teachers into the schools so that you can get these kids educated wherever they happen to be?
Hmm. Well put. An interesting challenge.
Well, I think we've acknowledged the importance of socioeconomic status or poverty, and yes, of course it's that way, and people who care a lot about education and who are well-educated themselves to have a strong tendency to send their children to private schools, or if they can't afford that, to move to the suburbs. And I certainly agree with the gentleman's point also that we need to have better teachers. And what I think the two major ingredients are testing to make sure that they know the subject matter and effective pedagogy, and in addition to that, to have merit pay. So those that are particularly effective are better rewarded for the fine work that they do.
Well, I guess the secondary problem with, I think, the systemic problem with education in this country is the situation with pay, and I don't see how moving to a system where you're going to be judged on your costs, which all competitive institutions have to be, is going to change that. You're not going to attract a large number. You'll get some, but you aren't going to get large numbers of highly qualified people unless you give them a work experience and pay that are equivalent with what they can get in other jobs in the private sector. And that's not happening in education, and I don't see that that's ever going to change. I don't know how the management system is going to change that.
Well, there are several ways that that can be changed. One way of reducing costs is to have larger classes. And if you have better teachers in larger classes, you can actually reduce costs. And secondly, for subjects in high demand where it's difficult to get effective teachers, as I mentioned earlier, science and mathematics, they need to be paid more in order to attract them. And that's the way things work in a capitalistic system.
Sir, we thank you for the call.
Thank you.
A useful contribution. Gentlemen, we've got about 3 minutes left. Apologies to those still waiting on the line and to those who sent us email, which we didn't get around to reading. But what is likely to happen as this scenario unfolds? Is the voucher idea gaining in this country 50 years from now? Is that the way American education will be organized? Joe Best.
Yes and yes. I think school choice is spreading across the country. It's slower than what we had hoped, and that's because the advocates of school choice tend to be very grassroots, not well organized and not well funded, whereas the opponents of school choice, the teacher unions in particular, are just the opposite, very well funded, very well organized. So, but we're seeing in state after state programs passing. Arizona is launching all sorts of exciting new school choice programs. There are setbacks in Florida. The state Supreme Court has ruled unconstitutional some of the school choice programs there. But Milwaukee now is going to suddenly expand its program. A change in who the governor is this year in Wisconsin could create a statewide voucher program in Wisconsin.
Really?
And that could really invigorate the whole school choice movement. So, yeah, I think the signs are very good. It's spreading fast, and parents ought to get involved in this effort and contact their elected officials and advocate it.
Does one foresee a time, if not 50 years, 70 years from now, when there will be no public school systems in operation in the country?
Well, we've actually gone to that extreme in our book, but that may be hundreds of years down the line. But just as you would have, I love Milton Friedman's metaphor of the restaurants, that you ought to be able to go to any restaurant you want, and mm-hmm. you ought to pay for it yourself. And if you pay for it yourself, you'll take it more seriously. And I am, on the other hand, a little grim, because I think there's going to be a big fight, and could last several decades. The Democratic Party is split because there are two main constituents, blacks on the one hand, African Americans, and the teachers' unions are opposed. Teachers' unions don't want choice. Blacks on mm-hmm. many, many national surveys are strongly for it. On the other hand, the Republicans are also split because you have people who are interested in economic efficiency that would want to have more of a choice system and more competition. But on the other hand, you have suburban Republicans that don't want to have city kids in their schools. So there's a lot of dissension about this, and I think it's going to be fitful progress, and I think we'll see it as spotty in different places.
I thank you most sincerely, both of you, for joining us tonight. Our guests have been Joe Bast, president of the Heartland Institute, and Herb Wahlberg, visiting fellow at the Hoover Institution. They are the co-authors of the book Let's Put Parents Back in Charge. And on the opposite side of the same cover, the Spanish version of the very same text. And this is available for free, I gather, for anybody who asks for it. Is that right?
That's correct. Just call 312-377-4000 or visit our website, heartland.org.